Well, that's all I can wait. It's been all week. I've been dying to see this intentional software thing. We have Magnus Christensen, who is the VP of Software Development at Intentional Software, and we have Shane, who I know nothing about at all. So I imagine I will learn when you learn. Please welcome Magnus and Shane.
Thank you. Hello, thanks for having us here. It'll be a pleasure to present this. Now, we've heard here a lot about parsers, domain-specific languages that are textual versus graphical. We've looked at a lot of code here. And what I like to do is to put the word domain back in domain-specific languages. We're going to focus here today a lot about more on the domain. What is the domain, and how do we express domain? And I think if we would have a domain expert in this room over the last 2 days, they would be totally confused on who we're talking about. In our mind, the domain has a language already. it's the language of the domain experts, and of course they know what they want to express. And I think one of the big problems in the software development is that we force ourselves to express their domain knowledge in software code. And we all know that's just a horrible match, just impossible to express rich domain knowledge into software code. It gets scattered across the code, it creates this accidental complexity. A domain expert has no idea what we're talking about. They are just trying to answer the questions that they think are random from their perspective. So what we're trying to do at Intentional Software is to start from the other angle, saying what do these domain experts want to express? What are the domain knowledge that we need to capture? And then work backwards from that. We don't start with a parser, we don't start with a grammar, we start from the other direction. If you would think back, say, 50 years in the software industry, the 50s, early 60s, and look at the work they were doing at that point in time, of course they needed a way to feed the instructions to the machine, and the way they did that was punch cards. So of course you needed a parser to process the punch cards in, but if you think about the computing paradigms today, we don't need punch cards anymore, and still we feed the tokens to the compiler. So I think there's something that went wrong over the last 50 years. So we're trying to radically rethink how could this process work much better if we took a radical and fresh approach to it. So what we're trying to do at Intentional Software is to create an environment, and we use the word domain workbench to build on Martin's definition of language workbenches, but we focused on the domain and find a processable representation of domain knowledge. And I say processable, not computable here, so this is not necessarily Turing complete, but we can process the knowledge. And we're trying to find, is there a way to express this knowledge in a way that can accelerate the software innovation we need? And can we use these intentions from the domain experts to get to the software? And let me go through a little bit about what is the background here and what are the things we need to express. So in a software project, we typically have these two key players. A domain expert that are very precise in their domain, they know exactly what they want to say, but they don't know how to express it in the words of the programmer. The programmer, they are very precise in what the instructions that they need to give to the computer to be able to execute something on the machine. And of course, these two notions of precision and expression is very, very different. So the trick here is to find a combination of bridging or eliminating the gap between these two. The programmer, if you look at the x-axis here, his word about computing power, and at some point we pass this Turing-complete executable languages that can execute on a computer. On the other axis here, think about the domain abstractions. The business expert typically care about the business domain, and typically they are not expressing themselves in an executable language. So if we map the tools they use in these quadrants, we find that most of their work goes on in these two quadrants. And of course, this is where a lot of the domain knowledge exists today in the organizations. And of course, this is today not very processable. Yeah, you may be able to print it, but that's about it. Yeah, you might be able to analyze some stuff in Excel, but it's not very useful at precise input for the programmer. What we're trying to build in the domain workbench is a way to bridge these two domains, a way to express this type of information in a way that we can map it into a domain definition that can be mapped and transformed into something that's computable. Now, of course, that's a tall order, so let's see how we're doing that. In the old world, when we talk about programs, we mean the software is the program here. So there is something that the computer needs to run. And the programmer creates that list of instructions. And the domain expert, they typically have some other notation or some other expression of their domain expertise that they are typically maintaining in different files than the software code. And of course, they need to explain this to the programmer, and there's back and forth among these two. In the new world of the intentional software idea is that how can we create an environment where these two key players can collaborate? And the way they collaborate is that express the domain knowledge in the way that's suitable for the domain expert. Start from the domain expert's own domain and find the most natural notation for the domain expert. Then create an environment that processes this, transforms this into something that the computer needs to chew on. So the output is the same as before, but the way the process works and the way we define what is software is very, very different. In this world, the software means the domain knowledge and something that processes that domain knowledge. And this might be a little abstract for now, but let's look a little bit into why is intentional different. We have a very, very clear way to separate these domains. And typically, a business domain might be composed of multiple different subdomains. So we clearly separate the domain problems, and typically there are multiple domain expressions here, separated from the programs. We also describe how the program is generated, not what it is. For people that are familiar with complexity theory, might now have heard about the Kolmogorov complexity. This is exactly what Kolmogorov complexity is about. How it's way better way to describe how things are grown rather than how they are, what parts they have. Because our DNA works in the same way that we grow a body. DNA doesn't describe a body. The domain representation, as I mentioned, doesn't need to be computable. In most cases, it's not computable. But we can process it into something that is computable. Of course, this idea of do we have textual or graphical DSLs is total rubbish. The domain expert, who cares? I want to express what I want to express. In my domain, there might be a combination of these. So we have to allow graphical, textual, or symbolic notation. We have to raise ourselves to just not worry about what to ask you anymore. We edit these domains directly in the environment, and we don't do any parsing. We don't import text strings or punch cards anymore. And we, of course, have to mix multiple domains. So in a typical business domain or a technical domain, there are dozens of different domains that need to collaborate. So the idea of having domains be integrated and work together is extremely important. So if you look at this domain workbench we've been working on for a long time, so what are the main requirements? Well, first, domains must be easily transformable. So this needs to be a very, very clear way to transform domains into each other. Any customer notation must be acceptable. We need to be able to mix domains. Domains must be able to evolve without limitations. And this is something I mentioned last night in the panel discussion. These domains will rev much, much faster than what we're used to from programming languages. And this includes both the structure, or what do we want to express, and what is the notation we want to use to express those intentions. And we also need a common editing environment for these things, as well as something that I haven't heard anyone discuss, is groupware. How do we expect domain experts collaborate with each other and collaborate with programmers. So groupware is a very, very important aspect of this type of environment. So looking from the inside, and what are the main components here. So at the core, we have something we call the intentional tree. This is what Martin called the semantic model. This is not an AST. We could express ASTs in this, but it's way broader than that. This is where we capture a lot of the data about the domain. We use projectional editors to project it both actually to the programmer as well as to the domain expert. And they edit their domain code in the notation that they like. And of course, this projection is then bidirectional. So project things here, we do some editing, and that goes back to the intentional tree. On the back end, there might or might not be something that transforms this into regular code. Of course, this is a semantic model, so this could we could write an interpreter for this. We can evaluate this directly, and we'll show some examples of that later on. The parser intentional tree, a little bit, but what that is, this is a pretty unique data structure that has a uniform representation for all the domain code we want to express. It has strong identities throughout, as opposed to an AST or meta models or database schemas or XML documents, there's no fixed meta levels. So a node can reference other nodes. Like here I have an example of a return statement. So an assignment has a definition. What is an assignment or what is a division? And then I can define these as in terms of other more primitive definitions. So actually we have version storage, so all the nodes in the tree is versioned. The tree itself doesn't comply to a grammar or to a meta model, but each node in the tree knows what type of node it is. So we've separated these concerns in terms of what is the data versus what is the definition of that data. Yeah.
The data structure here, so it can go off and reference all kind of stuff, so really it's more of a complex graph.
Yeah, correct. So there is kind of a primary structure, which is trees, but you're right, there's lots of cross-references in here. The projectional editing is very useful because it separates the representation from the surface notation that we see on the screen or in an output. And as mentioned, this works in two directions, both editing as well as a display. And as we're manipulating the tree here, or the semantic model, we need to have special editing operations. And we'll show a little bit of that in the demo here. We have in the system a large number of notations to match any existing notations, tables, graphs, text, curly braces, if you like that, and so on. And of course, we need to match and be able to mix different domains. So we might have a domain that's graphical combined with something that's more table-oriented, combined with some more textual-oriented. Of course, it has to be resolved ambiguities because we're not parsing here. We have a much, much freer way to express ourselves, and there cannot be any ambiguity what we do edit. And of course, the domains has to be able to evolve very rapidly, independent of each other. We also use in the same environment for editing the programs and the schemas and so on. And we'll show a little bit of that too. So I'm going to ask Shane, who is our engineering director here in Bellevue, a few miles down the road, and is going to help me walk through a demo of how to use this system and how to program this system. Let's see if we'll skip. The examples I have in the slides, I had to send in the slides like everyone else a few weeks ago, and Martin brought this state machine example up. So we said, well, let's just do a state machine. So here is a program that defines a state machine. It's very straightforward. We define a domain def, a state machine, and a state machine is it's a machine program, a machine. It has states, it has events, it has commands, and so on. And the state has transitions and actions. Very, very straightforward. Nothing unique here. What's interesting is that we're now looking at a projection of the tree that defines this. So, Shane, why don't we select this whole state, okay. Dev state, and look at the native. So if you peek under, what are we actually looking at here? So if you go into a native here, which takes away all the surface syntax, this is actually the tree underneath. Or it's a projection of the tree that's more native than the real thing. We don't see grids and stuff like that here. But
you never get to see the real thing.
Yeah, right. The real thing exists in your mind only. So, of course, we don't see the semicolons here, for instance. Semicolons, since like Gila, we're also going to take over the world. We actually apply semicolons in the projection, not in the real thing.
And curly braces.
And curly braces, yeah. So let's go back to the C-sharp-like notation here.
But,
yeah.
Projection, is this supposed to be the language of the domain?
No, no. So this is a... This programming language here is a, we can say, domain-specific language to program the domain workbench. So the user here is a programmer, and they like curly braces. That's why we added a lot of curly braces here.
In your graph, you had the projection, and yes. You project yes. The domain expert.
Right.
I thought that's what you were doing. Just
no,
in this case, you can think of the domain expert being the domain creator, the programmer.
Yeah.
And so we're actually projecting the language for building domain work for building workbenches, which is this actually a collection of domains.
So we're still in the programmer role, building a state machine environment for a domain expert.
So the domain def is the model, and the definitions are different concepts in that model.
This language here is actually an extension of C sharp. So we have C sharp in here. We can actually scroll down a little bit. Is let's find some computation that goes on somewhere. Let's look at some transformation that uses native code. Here's an example. A command that uses a bunch of pretty standard C-sharp code. So we've added a bunch of keywords to C-sharp to be able to make it more intentionally what we want to express. So we're embracing and extending C sharp here. So scroll back. What we have more in the, we have a bunch of a domain definition that defines the schema, and then we add. Let's say we have a number of transition. This is still the domain definition. We have a bunch of domain definition that we're going to transform these to text and Ruby and so on. But let's scroll down and look at the some transformation of projections here. Here's some projections. Why don't we look at some how to write projection between the domain code and the screen here. Here's a very straightforward projection. We're saying, well, it's projection is implemented for the state machine language. And we're going to have project events. And we're going to project events as the table. And yeah, we're going to have a header. We're going to have rows. We're going to have columns. And that's it. That's how we're going to project events. Here we're going to project commands, and it's, again, very declarative. So I want to project those as the table, and so on. Here is a machine program. We're going to project it as a property sheet, and it's going to be a tree-like, not a sheet-like. So it's I'm going to use these styles, and so on. So it's very, very intentionally how I describe my projections here. Let's look at some transformations. So for each of the elements in the schema, I define these projections. Then transformation, here's how we transform, this case, the state machine language to code. I define a few transformation here for the machine program. This is an example where, rather than having a declarative way to transform this, I'm actually going to write C-sharp code. So here, from this one, vanilla code here.
With some quotes
yeah.
mixed in.
The buffer?
The quotes, yeah.
So in this case, I should go through it for each loop. And in this case, we would wanna, whenever you come in here, just add this to the intentional tree.
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. You have a number of these, as it says, unnamed projections. You define project as project field. Is there some naming scope or...
Let's look at one of them. The way it works is that we haven't given this guy a name yet. We say it's implemented for SML, simple graph. So yeah, we could have probably put some more.
Yeah, what you're saying is a not very good projection in our table of contents.
For example, I see project field events, and I'm going to presume that that's referencing project death event in terms of a scope reference.
Project field events, that guy?
Like this one.
And how does he relate to project death event?
So project field is, the events field is a field of the machine.
Definition.
And how does that relate to...
And so...
This projected content template keyword says to just descend on that field and take whatever the content in that field is and project it using whatever projector is associated with that content. So if the events field contains events, then the project def for each of those events will be executed. And so that's where the relationship comes from into the project def for event.
So let's compile this and see what happens.
Okay, in the interest of time here. So we're now transforming this, this tree into a set machine. Here's Martin's example of the tree of that particular state machine. Or that.
So this is kind of a free projection that you get if the program that you've written isn't loaded. As soon as it finishes compiling, it'll update with the projection from the code, the default projection.
This is the, here we go. So we're using the table projection here to just display this state machine. And we have a number of events, we have a number of commands, and so on. And here, of course, we can go through and look at some of the other projections. So why don't we look at the code projection?
Well.
So this is one of the examples that Martin had in his example with a more concise contextual DSL for the state machines. And we use Ruby style syntax. And for people that like the XML, we have that option too.
Yeah, very important to have the XML version. Oh.
And let's look at the graphical projection. Just go through projecting the same thing through the graphs. And what else?
We can do some C# code.
Well,
which looks a lot like the Java code, by the way.
A traditional Java code, and then the Fluent.
So if you were to edit this right now, right, you would know how to project a command back to the model itself.
Yeah, we can do some editing here.
Yeah.
We pick some edit in the Ruby notation, so we change the simple single alert panel, and let's go back to the...
What's that?
Just to project that in the graphical view, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Oh, have, so we changed the name of this command, and then make sure I don't try to just there.
So, can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there are things you can express in one of the projections that won't translate into others.
Right.
You could put perfectly valid Ruby code in there that wouldn't map at all. How would that translate? What would you do?
Yeah, so if you add the Ruby code to it, right, so you can either use a Ruby elements in the tree itself, and then of course you decide in the graph projection.
Oh, I'm sorry, but if you go to back to the Ruby projection.
Okay.
You can just put whatever Ruby code in there you like, right?
Yep.
And then what happens when you go back to the state machine? Graphical projection.
Right. So in the graphical projection, we don't show any of the code. So it's still in the tree, but it's deleted from that particular projection. It's up to you when you write the projections.
And anything that was actual Ruby intentions would continue to project as Ruby wherever it is in the document in the other projections that are more text-oriented. For example, I don't know if you've noticed, this paragraph about Ms. Grant's controller has been sort of staying here the whole time, and it's actually not part of this domain at all. It's in a text editing domain that allows, you know, for headings and paragraphs.
Can you mix projections? Like,
oh yeah, we're mixing. The question was, can you mix projections? We're mixing projections right here.
Text here.
This is a word processing type mini domain. This is the state machine.
Stuff where, you know, like part of it is very functional and where F sharp would be great for defining what I want to do. I could have F sharp sitting there right in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, maybe now's a good time to go look at the transformation inspector here.
Sure.
So we go into a debugging information around this information. So we have a bunch of test cases here we're going to try. So here we're looking at what actually happens in the projection. And out here, we look at what's on the screen, right? This is what we saw here. We can scroll down. Here's the state machine. And this came from a number of steps through the state machine projection. And if we pick something here on the screen, we pick an event, for instance, and start going back. So we're stepping back. If you step back through the projections here, this came from this guy. That if you keep going, and here we see it's in a cell and it has some information in it. We step going back in the projection into the next one. We're going to go into is the state machine language itself here. Here we go. Here we see this is an event. So, and of course, if we look at the you want to go all the way back to the splitter?
Sure.
And so this is where it takes the domain and saying, oh, I have two domains going on here. I have a state machine domain and I have a text editor domain.
Right, so if we go up to
so if you look at the text, the tree, text part.
We actually have this section here. And the system looks at that and says, oh, this is from a different domain. So I'll send that off to something that understands it. And when we go forward on that, we now move to that other line.
Right, so now we go traversing, inspecting what's going on in that particular transformation here.
And we can do things,
Keep going all the way out to the screen.
Okay.
And see just how it connects back into the... So it becomes a chapter here. And out here is... Sure, it's vertical. And out here we have this section here. Yeah,
how does this work with source control and multiple people working on the project?
Great question. Should we jump into that a little bit? Actually, I think let's look at the other example because we don't have... We're just looking at a file here. So...
Actually, it's... Mm-hmm. Just to show real quick that as we... We can look at some of the other projections we had, such as the graph projection. Now you can see that there's actually an additional transformation going on where we actually change it into a graph domain first. And that continues down the projection pipe.
Mm-hmm. Back to this text node in there, that obviously doesn't change the meaning of my instance, of my domain. That specific state machine is not changed by adding the text paragraph. What happens if it should? If something in there actually changes what I described, mm-hmm. How can it be possible that this gets combined in a useful way?
Yeah, so we're not doing natural language processing here, trying to figure out what Ms. Grant's supposed to do.
Maybe I put in something that has meaning in the sense of state machines.
Right,
yeah. Whatever, parallelize it. How can these different aspects of what I describe in my domain then suddenly make sense?
Absolutely. You would still need to contribute an additional semantic model that understood how to combine the various domains that you are combining. I mean, you can't get that for free, obviously, in a semantic sense. What we're showing is that you can project them together. You can have different notations mixed for those domains. It certainly doesn't solve the, I think maybe you're getting at the code generation problem, you know, if I put something here that says to parallelize, that knows how to parallelize anything, or just describes the idea of parallelization, right, that you would still have to have some code that understood that model of it, for sure.
So let's just go back quickly to the state machine before we jump over to a different domain. Just look at the thing with the debugging, setting a breakpoint. Oh, okay. We have ran a little bit out of time here. So if you want to set up when you run one of these transformations, let's say I'm not debugging these transformations here. We have a way to set the breakpoint here, for instance, and run the transformation and bust up when I hit that line of code. I think we should, just show the CL1 the tools, the debug stuff here. So this way to the traditional way to just step through things here. Anyway, let's go over to a different domain, electronics, because I think this is a kind of, we kind of get it. This is a nice way to do different notation state machines. Now, in this particular case, we're looking at electronics. And, of course, how many are electronical engineers in the room here? Yeah, a couple of them. Oh, fantastic. Then you know very well that in the domain definition of electronics, we need to have circuits. We need to have series circuits and parallel circuits. And we have different types of circuit elements, like source, resistors, and inductors, and so on. So scroll up here. So we have essentially defined what does it mean to be an electronic circuit there. Here is a circuit. As example one, a circuit has a parallel circuit, serial circuit, and again, this is an intentional tree of one particular circuit.
So in this case, we've embedded the example document into the program itself.
So let's compile the program and see how we can play with this particular circuit here. So what we're doing now is defining a lot of the projections for these things. How do we project resistors, switches, lamps? What does it mean to be an inductor? What's a farad? Et cetera, et cetera. What's ohm? And here's a pretty, very crude form of, okay, well, here's a serial circuit. This has some impedance. Let's do the circuits layout to get however you feel for it first. Okay, so here's a circuit here. Let's flip the switch and see what's going on when we're running this. Oh, the light goes on. Let's turn off the light.
This debugging model was hard.
Yeah. We can go in and look at this particular resistor here and see what actually goes on there. So we're going to project that particular node in a little bit more detail. So we have 1,000 ohms and impedances here. So let's actually put some voltage on this circuit and see what's going on here. So turn it up, and sure enough, we now have this particular one, voltage, this current. And change in the 2,000 ohms to, say, 200 ohm circuit, which is we are now actually running the model itself. This is what Ken Martin was talking about, the semantic model you actually interpret. There's no code generation, we're just running it. And of course, here's where I think we are a little bit silly in that. Well, it has to be textual or graphical. And if electrical engineer would say, well, here's some text, here's graphic, what are you guys talking about? Of course, it has to be a combination of those. We can look a little bit closer on maybe how this is done, how the calculations are done. Of course, it's this. Has some pretty brutal transformations on how at least for you guys who are electrical engineers, how you actually get to these numbers here. So they're pretty, yeah.
Where do I download this?
We'll come to that. Here's again an example of the C# code embedded in this domain definition.
Let's say we're, so yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of, you know, the way that it's working, you know, you're not really going to be able to tell it from the code, but, so it calculates a lot of state for the whole circuit. And then that state is actually stored in a way that it's available to the rest of the transformation that occurs later to project those voltage and current values, for example.
So the idea here is when you've got some serious complexity in the underlying model, that you would you tend to embed code in it like this, is this, or not necessarily?
Yeah, it depends on how you want to express that complexity. So we have way to declare very declaratively, or more like a template style, or raw code as this.
Yeah, but this transformation is clearly like, I mean, it's a test of the actual domain, right? It's just we're doing it in a way that the results of running that test can be used to enhance the editing of the domain itself.
Should we look at the actually real? These are kind of toy examples. We have been... What we're looking at here is IDW 1.2. We actually shipped. We didn't tell many people about it, but we actually shipped a few months ago. And what we're looking at here is the 1.2 version we released last week. We are releasing about every 6 weeks or so right now. But some of our early customers and partners, so Capgemini, which is a large systems integrator in both Europe and here, have been working in financial systems or financial services system for a number of years, and we work with them on defining some of these. So this is a product that Capgemini is offering right now based on the intentional system. This is a pension calculation system for pension experts. Yeah, I know. We actually had that feature at some point. Let me just scroll through here very quickly. This is kind of a standard, you know, Word document. In here, I mentioned actuarial notations last night here. Here's an example of what these are, actuaries. And again, very precise people that knows how to express math. And of course, they were using Word in the past with the equation editor to patch up. I don't know if you noticed these types of very weird types of notations here. And it's kind of very... hard to do. Well, it's impossible to do that in the equation editor. So they've been, and of course, this is all, you know, in IntelliSense and so on. So they can edit the domain directly here. And of course, we can do a bunch of interesting transformations. So let's look at how this one expands. This is actually how this is calculated, right? If anyone cares. Let me look at some more interesting rules. So what's happened when these domain experts are now editing their domain in this type of precision, which, of course, is precision in their domain. I remember one of the guys said, who thought for a long time, saying, no, we have actually to be correct, what we tell the programmers. Because in the past, they handed off these Word documents, and if there was some problem with them, the programmers used to come back and say, do you really mean this? Oh, no, that's an error, so they patched up. But say, no, we have actually to be precise and be correct what we're telling them, because there's not this quality check in the IT division. So what we've been doing is to build in a lot of these kind of debugging features. And one is just making sure that they are using the right language. So, for instance, here is a way to express rules. Of course, we're getting them all these types of help to construct correct rules. But we're also adding test cases to them. So here's an example of where we are embedding rule tests. And here in this particular rule, I have a number of rules that are all green at the moment. And again, I'm here evaluating the rules interactively. So now see, as I'm changing the rule, the system runs and say, oh, no, actually this test doesn't pass anymore. I can also go in and say, okay, well, if a rule doesn't apply or passes here, what actually happened. So we can go in and actually debug what actually how this calculation actually went on. And here's just an example of this is a kind of a printf, or how did actually this calculation happen? And this will go through the exact calculation of this particular was an algorithm formula that looks like this, and this breaks down how the calculation happens, so we can inspect the actual values here. And so this is an example of where we are starting from the domain express domain and saying, what do you want to express? How can we build an environment so you, domain expert, can express in detail all the things, your intentions? And then, given that, how can we, as programmers, transform that into something that's useful, either as code generation or as something that we did in the electronics, actually run the model directly? So I know Chris' favorite questions. Is this available? Who's using this? This is what, right now we are only mentioning two customers. Capgemini is using it, and ThoughtWorks are early users of this. This year we're doing a bunch of pilot projects in a bunch of different domains, and I hope next year I'll be able to show a lot more examples, more than outside of the financial services space. So thank you so much. Yeah.
So your two customers, are they using it internally, or are they channel partners and they go out?
Yeah, so in the Capgemini case, so they have built the Pension Workbench. That's a product they offer to, and they are out now and selling it and installing it in different banks. So there's a couple of banks that are now starting to migrate the pension funds over to the Capgemini Pension Workbench.
Mm-hmm. So how long, like in terms of man hours, would it take to build a customer? All the assets.
Great question. Obviously, you can build something like the Pension Workbench. Oh, so how long will it take to build something like the Pension Workbench?
From what you ship.
From what you ship, yeah. Okay, so the Pension Workbench is approximately, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 lines of code in the system. Including, I think it includes like 12, 13 different domains. There's a temporal rule language, which is the most complex. Temporal in the main, you can talk about time. There's a pension plan product domain. There is a rule test domain. There's a system test domain. And there's a couple of other domains. So all those domains are captured, including all the projections and transformations in maybe 2,000 or 3,000. Then each code generator, we built a Java code generator, and that's about 1,000 lines of code. Obviously, it depends on what you want to do in the code generation. But this particular one generates a Java web service that's a calculation engine based on these rules. Yeah, Larry.
Okay. What if your domain expert insists that a symbol on using an ambiguous symbol in their domain? They just won't disambiguate it. Can you?
They want to do what?
What, they draw lines with arrows, you know, and it means a whole bunch of different things. And they, you know, the CEO doesn't have time to choose between different types.
Yeah.
Can you maintain an ambiguous symbol and then later have another person come in and say, oh, when they mean this?
You can add things here that's ambiguous, that doesn't even comply to the schema. We will still collect the information. We didn't actually show the...
Well, something to consider is that those things don't necessarily need to be ambiguous in this kind of an environment. Four or five different definitions in the language could all have a name of dash greater than. And depending on the context that you are in the model, the correct one will be chosen by the edit help to allow them to type dash greater than wherever they want to type it. And, of course, projected as a Unicode arrow instead of a dash and a greater than.
So one question we got was earlier here about, how does this work with version control systems? Now, remember, this is an environment for domain experts that are very uncomfortable with version control systems and programmers that are very comfortable with it. So the environment includes a groupware support to actually trace and version every change. And it's pretty, what we try to do is to make it very, very easy to use for both a domain expert. So there's things like, you know, update from the repository, commit to the repository, and so on, as well as for the programmer. So we,
In the repository, we can store both the domain definitions as well as the code environment. And of course, there are diff tools and stuff like that to be able to facilitate groupware. Yeah. Martin, another question?
That was it. I just wanted to make sure you didn't let that question go by. I think that's a really important point.
The groupware. Yeah.
So as far as I understood, the customer is building something, the group building this particular system, inspection system. It includes both the main experts and the C# programmers. Now the question is, just when building this thing looks like really complex, how often they needed help from the experts?
You mean like Capgemini's programmers? Or
Yeah, programmers, yeah.
What's the learning curve to build something?
This table final, so that it's every day somebody is stuck, for example, or once a week only.
Yeah. So there is a learning curve, learning how all this works. However, good programmers are very good at adopting new technology. They are now essentially building these types of environments essentially interactively with the domain experts. It's kind of hours, we're talking hours. We actually had a situation where the domain experts themselves start changing the schema because they want to express something else. So we actually had feature here that actually there is a way for domain experts also to change the schema themselves if they can't express what they want to say.
Yeah, but in terms of assistance,
I think it's. I mean, we help them. They're smart people. They read the documentation, and we've had a few workshops with them, maybe a week. Go through the tutorials. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you build the intentional domain workbench using the intentional domain workbench?
Yes, we like to drink our own whiskey.
Yeah.
We don't like dog food.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, we do still have there's a portion of the kernel, we'll call it, that's developed in C#. But as much as possible, we do the projections and transformations in CL1. It's just a lot more expressive for the kind of thing that we're trying to do with this language, you know, in terms of doing the transformations, having the nice quoting available.
And so what projections do you find yourself using? Do you project your C# code in Java?
We don't get a lot of time to spend on doing projections for ourselves, so that's why you kind of see that, you know, CL1 right now just kind of looks a lot like some mashed up version of C#, you know, the CL1, this language that we're developing in. But, you know, anyone who does use it can actually add projections even for the built-in languages. So
you guys find yourselves working mostly in C#?
In
building the intentional domain workbench?
No. Okay. But the projections that we use in our workbench tend to look a lot like C#. Okay. Because we haven't put a lot of extra effort into doing a custom projection of our own language. So a lot of the, you know, any place where we could get by with expressions or statements just looking like C#, since we needed a good projection of C# anyway, we've just kind of done that.
I was just curious if you had, like, workflows laid out as workflows or state machines laid out as state machines, or... And it sounds like no. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's a good migration path from, a C# WPF project to be able to... So basically load in and then start migrating to add DSL.
That's a great question. We do have a C# parser to get in legacy C# code and then start migrate. I don't know, Shane, you want to talk a little bit more.
Yeah, we do.
Some of the stuff that we've done ourselves.
Yet another GLR implementation today. But we do have a parser for language. You can write grammars and parse them. And we've done that for C# using our own parser generator, and so you can import that code. The other thing that you can do is just use it as an API, right? If you have a decent framework API that can form the basis for your semantic model, and then you just have to sort of design a language and a domain around that API that you already have, and then you can start to think about the projections of that model after that.
How much does this text editor feel like a text editor? Like when you project to text, is it like you all this copy-paste experience and stuff? Do you have that, or is it quite limited? You're editing nodes and labels and stuff. Like, how much does it feel like text?
It feels when you're in the documentation field, field.
It's definitely not. The question is, how much does it feel like text? It is not exactly the same as text, and I don't think we will ever get it to be exactly the same as text. We have some different editing modes that we experiment with for changing up the navigation between fields and the navigation around the nodes. So you can actually, you know, we have pretty decent expression editing where when you're editing, you know, typing in a mathematical equation, for example, you can type an identity space, the operator space, identity, and it processes that and builds the tree correctly based on precedences that are associated with the operators and the projections. But it's definitely not just, you know, a pure text editing feel.
For the languages we already have, couldn't you like go forth and back with a parser? Would you lose tons of stuff? When I'm in some C-sharp mode, couldn't I just edit it as C-sharp and then just go back to the node afterwards? Associated with it in the background that I...
We experimented with that in the past. The question was, could you just go back and forth between text when you're using a language that is a text-based language, I think is pretty much the question. We experimented with that a little bit of having, you know, tying in the grammar, so to speak, and then actually, you know, you could choose some block of the code to work on and you know, put it into text mode, and it would allow you to type, and then when you had valid language again, it, you know, would parse. It just turns out that it's not that big of a deal once people have gotten used to it. And primarily our concern right now is the productivity of the domain experts and not the programmers. And they care even less. They are very, very comfortable working with the structured environment, and in fact, I think in some ways they're almost more comfortable because it gives them a sense of knowing where they are and what kind of information they can enter at that point.
Kind of the same stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So they just help you through the code. So, mm-hmm.
I'll repeat the question. Mm-hmm. I think they asked earlier. So where can you download this from?
So you can. It's not available on the internet right now. If anyone is interested in doing a trial on a pilot project, please talk to me after this.
Is intentional software hiring, so we get you on the intranet?
Yes, we are hiring.
Yes.
We are hiring talented people, programmers and non-programmers. So we have, please contact us for that too. And we're based here, down the road.
So how do you see this getting operationalized in an actual working software system? Let's say I use a model, a line of business system for my domain experts, mm-hmm. and they actually expect working software at the end of this whole process. Right. How does that look like?
So let's take a look at what Capgemini is doing. So what they do is that they go out and start adding pension funds to their domain. And then they run all the validation and tests and stuff like that. And then they have, like I mentioned, they have a Java generator, if that's what they want to generate. Well, they also looked at the generator towards rules engines, so which, of course, is a different generator from that. And then, of course, once you generate that, then you're kind of in the old world. So you test that traditionally, and then it's just a WAR file or whatever, and deploy that.
So if I was a consultant using this tool, mm-hmm. my primary requirements, mm-hmm. I would be generating essentially a code generation on each particular project that's based on the nature of the architecture that I want to be born out of the process.
Yeah, it depends on what you're using. I know some banks are looking at just generating test cases from these definitions on their existing systems. So it can be used for the electronic stuff. There's no code generation in that, for instance. It just runs it directly.
And do you guys offer some sort of productivity enhancement for code generation, like a template language or something like that?
The code generation right now is typically done exactly the same way as the projections are done, what we've been showing you. the projections, for example, in the state machine, this Ruby code, we have a stage in the pipeline where we'll take anything that's being projected to the screen and just project that to text instead. So the idea is you just get things looking on the screen like that valid language and then write it to text. Now we do have domains built in for common generation targets like C# and Java.
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of energy around things like test-driven development, and I'm thinking about that in context of what we're seeing here. Would you imagine that somebody would take, like, okay, so a business analyst, I was doing like behavioral-driven development, so a business analyst would sit there using the language and write out the cases, and that would generate to the language of choice, and then would you imagine that somebody would continue to work in this workbench, or that a programmer might take that and then move out into their tool of choice and then bring it back when they're done and make it? How do you see that work?
I think it's a great question. I think there's clearly connections to behavior-driven development. Dan North says that BDD is like poor man's intentional. So we're actually working with Dan a little bit of can we actually build something with this and use the BDD ideas. I think there's also a great connection to domain-driven design, ubiquitous languages and stuff like that. So that's exploring ideas. What does this mean in the new world? That's why we're kind of a little bit conservative of how we roll it out, because a lot of these questions, we just don't know yet. But I think there's lots of potential on finding good connections here.
So this talk's already gone on 20 minutes longer, because I couldn't stand to stop either. Thank you very much, Magnuson.